This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
This is The Conspiracy Show, but it's not Richard Serrett this evening. My name is Victor Vigiani, sitting in the big chair. While Richard is silent, actually not really, he's in Seattle. And as they say in the biz, he's on assignment, filming the weird and wonderful things that he always does best, that is unveil the hidden truth in this most strange place that we call reality. He does such a great job at it, too. So he's left me in the big chair, and here I sit. With any kind of luck, we will do some justice to the big chair tonight, and hopefully you will enjoy that. In this hour, coming up, we're going to have a bit of a strange conversation, and I hope that you'll bear with us because it will stretch your imagination beyond belief. And it's about the merging of souls. This young lady, her name is Jeannie Klein, has had it happen to her. Somehow she has managed to merge with another soul, a deceased soul. If that's not strange enough, the soul she has merged with, hold on to your hats, is Superman. Well, actually, not really. She's merged with the deceased actor, George Reeves, with his soul, believe it or not. Somehow, inexplicably, these two share a soul. I'm not sure how it works, but we're going to be speaking with Jeannie and her good friend and therapist, Gary Duncan, later on in a few minutes. But before that, I just want to run a few things by you. As you probably know, I have a deep interest in the phenomenon of UFOs. More so the political aspects of the whole crazy phenomenon we all know as UFOs, and more so the political aspects of the disclosure movement around trying to get the government to come forward about what they know about this whole thing. And when I say government, I'm talking about the world governments, who definitely have some idea what's going on, but they're just not telling us. But there's been a really significant development over the past, I'd say, 3 or 4 months, and it's got a bit of a twist to it. And I'd like to try to just run that by you to sort of update you on what's really going on, because this reaches right into the White House, deep into the White House. And it's all about a man named John Podesta. Now, John Podesta was, during the administration of Bill Clinton, President Bill Clinton, he was the chief of staff, a pretty high-profile position within the, probably one of the most high-profile besides the vice president, chief of staff within the White House. And he did that up to the year 2000. And following that, he got hooked up with two people. Actually, what I should do is tell you that while he was in the White House, it was no strange matter to know that John Podesta was interested in the phenomenon of UFOs. His nickname was Skippy. I don't know exactly what that means. Maybe like peanut butter. I'm not quite sure. But he made it known to many people within the White House that he was interested in this whole phenomenon called UFOs. So along comes the year 2000, and he finishes up with Mr. Clinton in the White House, and he hooks up with a young lady named Leslie Kane and another young fellow named James Fox. Now, Leslie Kane was a Boston Globe journalist at the time, and she wrote the book, UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on Record. And that particular book went to number 29 on the New York Times bestseller list. That's quite an accomplishment. And also, he hooked up with James Fox, a film producer who many of you might know produced the film Out of the Blue. So anyways, these three people went forward, and they had a press conference, and he went public. John Podesta went public at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., asking the government, no, pardon me, demanding that the government come clean about UFOs. Now, this was done at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., and as you are probably aware, that location, I've been there a couple of times, I've spoke there actually twice, is the place where John F. Kennedy spoke. Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, just about every president that you can imagine has said something significant about where they stand on issues from the National Press Club. And John Podesta said this at the National Press Club.
I think it's time to open the books on questions that have remained in the dark on the question of government investigations of UFOs. It's time to find out what the truth really is that's out there. We ought to do it really because it's right. We ought to do it because the American people, quite frankly, can handle the truth. And we ought to do it because it's the law.
Now, can you imagine that? A former White House chief of staff ending his tenure in the White House and then hooking up with two UFO advocates by the names of Leslie Kane and James Fox, and coming forward in such a public manner to demand that a government that he worked for come forward about the UFO issue. Now, that's not really the strange part. What comes next is this recent development. Within the Barack Obama government right now, as you are probably aware, his administration is flagging. He's virtually almost a lame duck president. Many people have characterized it that way. At least I do. And Barack Obama saw fit way back when to have John Podesta, at the beginning of Barack Obama's tenure as president, he assigned him as the co-chair of the transition team into the White House. Every president has a transition team that they smooth out all of the ripples and the bumps as the new president moves into into the White House. And that position lasted a couple of months and it ended, and John Podesta went on to do other things at the time. But about 3 months ago, Barack Obama names this fellow, John Podesta, as a special counsel to the White House to reboot the flagging Barack Obama administration. Now, my question is, why would Barack Obama, for whatever reason, assign John Podesta, a known UFO advocate, who's come forward to the National Press Club, as special counsel for his administration? I find this absolutely bizarre and almost to the point of unbelievable. Now, you can call it speculation if you wish. You know, it's just coincident. But what else can you call it? I say it's a movement towards some kind of disclosure. It's a sign that somebody on the inside is going to make some sort of move towards disclosure. I could be wrong. A lot of times we are when we start speculating that way. In any case, I just thought I'd share that with you because I think it is very, very important that we pay attention to these signs. If you want to know more about it, you can go to my website, Zeeland Communications. Just Google Zeeland Communications and you can have a look at not only what you heard this evening with John Podesta, but all the documents that have emanated from the White House in the Clinton administration about demands that the administration of Bill Clinton come forward to end the secrecy surrounding the UFO issue. You can also go to Stephen G. Bassett's website, Paradigm Research Group, And at that site, you can see all the letters and you can see all of the information about John Podesta. And I think we'll be looking for some real action that might come forward as a result of this development. I think we can move forward now. And with our evening with Jeannie Klein and Gary Duncan, it is a very, very strange story. A story that, if you're sitting down, you'll be okay. If you're standing up, you just might fall over when you start hearing the kinds of things that will stretch your imagination beyond control. So I'd like to welcome Jeannie at this time, Jeannie Klein and Gary Duncan. Not too bad. How are things there now?
Pretty good. This is in Durham, North Carolina, and our weather is a little bit different than yours up there.
I'm hoping that it is, because up here we've got, I can't tell you how much snow. It's just been an amazing, two or three weeks. We've had absolute blistering cold, absolute snow beyond belief. And I guess just things falling from the sky that, and apparently we're supposed to be getting some more too, and it's been one heck of a winter. So welcome to the show, Gary, and also, Jeannie, are you there?
Yes, good evening.
Good evening. And where are you located this evening?
Texas.
In Texas, I hope.
The Metroplex.
I see. The big storm that we got over the past couple of days came from the northern part of Texas, as I understand it.
We passed all along to you all.
Well, thank you very much. It was a really nice gesture. Anyways, I want
more tomorrow, so expect more next week.
Terrific. I want to kind of get an indication from you both, Jeannie, just as an idea. You were 13 years old when the spirit of George Reeves came to you. And apparently, it happened on the day that he of his demise. I believe it was June 16th, 1969. And
59.
Pardon me, 59. And it happened all at once. I know we're going to get into this more deeply, but I really have a great interest in finding out, did this thing hit you all of a sudden? Was it a gradual thing? Did you recognize what was going on? How did that happen?
Well, I think we were on vacation, and I just knew, he came to me and said, I'm gone now, but I'll never leave you. And it was one of those things that, when you're, essentially a kid, you think, what's going on here? And then you go on, and we were on vacation at the time in Colorado, so there were a lot of other things going on. But as, the years progressed, things started to happen, and I knew things, and, it just became more part of my life that, I found that our lives, a lot of things paralleled, and, he was always there.
Did you recognize him as George Reeves?
Oh, yes.
You did. Okay. Well, as you can hear in the background, we have a musical bed there. That indicates that we have to take a bit of a break. Just stay with us. We'll keep on going on the other side of the break. My name is Victor Vigiani, and you're listening to The Conspiracy Show.
Adventures of Superman. Faster than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound.
Look, up in the sky. It's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's Superman. Yes, it's Superman. Strange visitor from another planet who came to Earth with powers and abilities far beyond those of mortal men. Superman, who can change the course of mighty rivers, bend steel in his bare hands, and who, disguised as Clark Kent, mild-mannered reporter for a great metropolitan newspaper, fights a never-ending battle for truth, justice, and the American way.
I played that clip for a very specific reason. And it's almost a strange synchronicity, both you and Jeannie and Gary. As a young boy, I grew up with George Reeves, every single episode of Superman. I had the red cape, I jumped off the side of my couch, pretended that I could fly. Up at the cottage, I would leap off the swing that my granddad had built in the back of the cottage on the two big pine trees, and I'd fly through the air, pumping hard so that I could get as much velocity going as I could. On an occasion, I would hit the side of the cottage, and it would be very, very painful. So I realized then I really wasn't made of steel. But the whole synchronicity of how this is happening this evening with someone like myself who's who literally grew up with this fellow, both Superman and George, I find it a very interesting coincidence, if nothing else. Gary, you've had a career in research. You spent near 21 years in the private practice as a psychotherapist and sex educator, as a licensed professional.
Right.
You've had quite a background, and even as a Gnostic Catholic priest. So you have pretty well covered the whole gamut of the psychological aspects of this, as well as the spiritual aspects of this.
Right.
At the beginning of this whole thing, how did you first meet Jeannie?
I was teaching some courses at the University of Cincinnati, and Jean came into my my autumn course, and I was teaching a course on dreams in the winter, and she was in that course. And then I was teaching a course in the spring on Western inner traditions, and she came in that course. And all through those, the first meeting, she asked for my card, my business card, and eventually in the third quarter, she set up an appointment. The odd thing was, on the day that she set up the appointment, I picked up the phone to make an outgoing call, and she was on the line already, and that just sort of blew me away. She set up an appointment, and when she came in, told me the story that there was a spirit with her by the name of George Reeves. You know, as a psychotherapist, the first thing that popped in my mind was that I'm dealing with a psychotic here. And she presented a picture of him.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't a George Reeves fan or a Superman fan. By the second interview I had with her, this spirit began to talk to me. And immediately I thought, well, I may be dealing with a multiple personality here. But as time went on, I became eventually convinced that Jean was having some kind of a delusional experience. And I set out to crack some holes in it. But as time went on, it flipped back on me. And as a matter of fact, we ended up at the Super Museum in Metropolis, Illinois. And through Jean, George names costumes he wore, ones he didn't wear, a certificate from Pope Pius, all confirmed by the curator. And I was totally blown away. And so all of my little psychological theories began to crumble. And eventually, because of that experience with Jean and George, and some other experiences, I was working with people that were dying of AIDS, and I was having some profound spiritual experiences there as well. Those combined, I eventually left being a psychotherapist and became a Gnostic Catholic priest. So I view this whole experience as a continuum from the psychological to the spiritual.
Now, could you just very quickly, if you could, kind of encapsulate the clinical description of this merging of the souls? We're not talking about, you know, two separate entities here or soulmates. You're talking about some sort of merging. What's the clinical description of this,
well,
if there is one?
We have none. The closest we can come to, or closest I can come to, is like a unitive experience in which, like the mother and the child, or the baby that is in her, when she gives birth, she's still psychologically and spiritually connected with that child.
Mm-hmm.
Jean and George are similar. Now, in their particular case, they say that their soul split apart as male and female and has gone through lifetimes after lifetimes experiencing different variations of love. This whole concept can be traced back to Plato. And also the Persians talked about it, this concept of twin souls. And when the merger takes place is when the souls have gone through various incarnations, and they're ready to finish a specific lifetime, and then they merge to go on and experience other lifetimes. So my hunch is that this lifetime, George is waiting for Jean to die so they can be together and go into the light together. George hasn't gone into the light. So my hunch is that this is the last lifetime that Jean and George are going to have in our physical reality, and they're going to move on. But it is a unitive experience. It's almost like a... So to classify it in a psychological or psychiatric way is very difficult. Real way of looking at it is through a spiritual context, and that's why I call it a unitive experience. Those experiences are in the mystical, and Jean and George are having that type of experience.
Jeannie, what does it feel like? Can you give us a sense of what it actually physically feels like to experience this?
In what respect?
Well, I'm sitting here trying to imagine.
From me or it's kind of evolved, like you said. Things, as we have gone along, have kind of changed. And I guess as I'm getting older and getting closer to, you know, the end days, it's going to change even more. That he's more part of me. And, you know, for Gary, we would split off sometimes. I mean, he did all kinds of experiments to see, you know, what was going on when we were getting together. And now it's hard to tell the difference. I live my life now, and this is what George wants, that I get the experiences here. But, you know, he's still here. He's still part of me. And, you know, and I can tell sometimes the difference in thought processes, as it were, things he wants me to experience as he did, in a way.
So I guess what I'm asking you, too, is when you find out information like Gary just told us about the costumes, the ones he did wear and the ones he didn't wear during the TV program, how would he have related that to you? Would it be a verbal communication? Would it be some sort of sensual experience? Would it be a telepathic experience? Just how would that information have been transmitted to you?
It's just like talking to you. He was talking. It's like he was using his experience and talking through me, as it were, that I was the, you know, I guess the popular word is medium, but that wasn't exactly it.
Right.
You know, it was him saying, you know, this, I didn't use that. You know, this was some other time, and, you know, this obviously was put together, and I would just know things.
All right.
Would this experience be like almost predestined? It was supposed to happen at some point in your life? I mean, what kind of bond is it, and how intimate is it, and how drawn was he to you or you to him?
Oh, yeah, it was meant to be, you know, and we found that out later on as, you know, we went through things that, and I guess that's why, you know, as you were as a child, I was drawn to him.
Mm-hmm.
And after I grew, I didn't know why after a while. And it wasn't just the Superman show. I'd know other things that he was doing, other films, other parts of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, it was, you know, I'm showing you how it was with me, and this is how it's going to be with you.
I see. Gary, I want to throw something at you. Do you get a sense that George Reeves, as you have come to know him through Jeannie, do you think that he was, at some point in his life or all of his life, was he predisposed to this kind of psychological, whatever you might want to call it? Was it something that he knew about, or that it was eventually going to happen, or did it just happen, or was he predisposed to it all of his life?
Let me give you a term. There is a term in psychiatry called a dual unity, mm-hmm. and that is very similar to what is going on with Gene and George. Now, to address this particular question that you just asked, mm-hmm. George didn't realize until he died what his destiny was with Gene. He had his he told me his spirit guide. And I forget the name of the spirit guide, but he told this spirit guide to find Gene, and he found Gene, and then George went to her and went into her dreams, and that's when he told her that he would be with her. Now, since you're talking with Gene, George is there as well, so you may want to ask George a question, mm-hmm. because when I used to work with them, I would talk with Gene a while, and then I would talk with George. Unlike a mobile personality, to where there's sort of an eye click, there's an odd stare, or some kind of a shift, it's like I was accessing both people, both identities, at the same time. And I even had an outside psychologist give them both a high-powered psychological a test called the MMPI, and there were two distinct identities. Gene took it once, and a few hours later, through Gene, George took it, and there were two totally different profiles that emerged. So there's two distinct personalities there. Now, I did an experiment once with George. I was trying to see if George could pull away from Gene. And I had a court appearance around an estate. One of my clients died. And George came to that court appearance, and he described it perfectly. So he was able to pull away from Gene. And normally he would be able to do that when Gene was asleep. But if you have a particular question that you want to address to George, you can do that, and he will answer you through Gene.
Mm-hmm. So there's actually a conduit through which George can express himself through Gene.
Right. And since you were a fan of George Reeves, you may want to ask him something. since you have... With Gene, you have them both there.
Well, I was just going to ask the question of Jeannie. You know, is this something that you can turn on and off, or is it just like he's there all the time tapping you on the shoulder and saying, it's my turn?
It's the latter.
Okay.
He doesn't always say, it's my turn.
he sort of jumps right, or he just flies right in, I guess, right? Yeah.
That was George.
That was just there. You know what? We'll talk to George when we get back. Because of my background with this man from Krypton, I just might be able to conjure up a question when we get back. My name is Victor Vigiani, and you're listening to The Conspiracy Show.
This is my first time actually meeting Gene Klein, and psychically I can sense the presence of George Reeves.
Nobody could really give me an answer why he came to me. Well, 3.5 years ago, I took one of Gary Duncan's courses, and I found out all the answers.
His client is having a relationship with the spirit of George Reeves, who was the television Superman from the 50s and 60s.
Well, it happened when I was 13 years old on the day he died, and it was George in white, and he said, I'm gone now, but I'll never leave you. I pulled the trigger, but someone else put the live shots in the gun.
Failed. George.
Yes. 13 years ago.
13 years ago.
Actually.
What kind of life?
7 years ago.
Okay. What kind of life are you living right now?
Very quiet in comparison to the way it was.
how, How was it before?
Well, you know, I was quite a nightlifer. She's not. We're antithesis.
I see. Tell me about your love-hate relationship with this role that you played.
Well, it got me the name recognition I wanted, but it killed my career, and that's why I feel sorry for the guys that came behind me. You know, look what happened to some of them, too. It's wanted a leg up, not a boot out the door.
I guess the other question that I have to ask you is, what is your assessment of the life that you lived?
Good question.
Well, we always can do better things. In Hollywood, you have a skewed view of reality as such, and when you become a quote-unquote personality, it becomes even more so. Mm-hmm. You can do a lot of good or you can do a lot of harm. And a few of the things I tried to do good with, and like her, I like to work with children. But on the other hand, you know, the partying and that got out of hand. But again, it's where you are and what you're doing at the time. And it's still that way. Part of being a celebrity is being out, and being out is out in the party life.
Mm-hmm. Are you planning another life to get it right this time? Or to try to make things right that you didn't have right to begin with?
Well, existence is a learning experience. You know, you find out, and that's when you leave, you find out, did I learn what I was supposed to learn this time? And if you didn't, then you find another existence to try to learn that lesson, more or less. Mm-hmm. And yes, we probably will. You know, as Gary said, maybe not here, but somewhere we will find out what we need to learn and learn that. You hate to say evolution, because that becomes a bad word in this reality, but you evolve into a higher being. Mm-hmm.
Do you take much time away from Jeannie?
Not a lot.
Why not?
No need to at this point.
I see.
No, but there was a time when I had to separate them. You remember that, George?
Yes.
Remember how peeved off you got at me?
Yes.
Okay, I just, it went through my mind. How do you feel talking to George? Did you notice the slight differences when you were talking with Gene?
Okay, with that, folks, we're going to take a break. I just need to catch my breath after that little episode. I just fell out of the chair. Let's take a break, and we'll continue this on the other side. You're listening to The Conspiracy Show, and my name is Victor Vigiani. Here we are back again. We are speaking with Gary Duncan and Jeannie Klein, and we're talking about, I guess, all of the aspects of their book, Twin Souls. That is the melding, or however you want to call it, of George Reeves and Gene Klein. Very quickly, Gary, if I could, the idea of what Jeannie is going through right now, and I sort of picked up on it in your article, regarding, first of all, regardless of what the materialists say, there is something very, very strange going on here, and there are other realities that they do exist. I think I know that for sure myself. I don't know how I know it, but I do know it. But the other thing that I want to address, it's a more physical aspect of what's going on here, not necessarily the more ethereal ones, and that is the idea that Gene is somehow shape-shifting, looking like the late George Reeves. Now, that is something that I find completely incomprehensible. Not that I don't believe it or not believe it, but I just, it's just hard to get my mind wrapped around that idea.
When that first started, I started taking pictures of Gene, and what I discovered, and this blew me away as a therapist, that they were having a sexual relationship. A spirit was and Gene in the physical flesh, and George in the spirit. And during the orgasmic phase, an energy would leave George and go into Gene. And as this process occurred, Gene started shape-shifting. She started looking more and more and more like George Reeves. And at that time, the first thing that crossed my mind was spirit possession, sort of like in the voodoo trance, the person in the trance, they shapeshift somewhat, and I started investigating that, but it didn't pan out. But there was some sort of an energy that was passing between George during those lovemaking sessions. And that's what I alluded to earlier, because it got so bad for Gene that it was totally exhausting. And I had to create a special room in Gene's inner world so that she could go into and be free from George Reeves during that period of time. But it was during that time that there was heavy lovemaking, and energy passed through him into her, and she started taking on his physical characteristics. And that's when I started taking pictures.
I see. And that seems to be evolving more and more.
Right. Gene has masculinized to the point that at times she can be in a ladies' room, and a woman will come in while Gene is in there, and she will look, and she'll see Gene and think that she's in the wrong bathroom.
I see.
And Gene will say, "No, you're in the right one." So she's becoming more and more physically masculine, looking more and more like George Reeves.
Now, Gene, do you actually feel this occurring, or how's that happening?
You mean the transformation?
Yeah, in a tactile sense.
Well, it's just kind of like aging. You know, you get up in the morning and, you know, the hair is gray now. You know, then it's the way it happened then. It was kind of gradual, and, you know, and I'd thought in the picture in the book, if you've seen it,
I
thought in a way I looked like him anyway. And I even wrote some letters because I thought, well, maybe there is a connection, and that's why I'm looking more like him. Maybe there is a background, you know, genetically, that, you know, we have a common relative because we were from the same, you know, from Illinois, the same areas.
Right.
Part of my mother's history, I don't know, because she was adopted, and, you know, he didn't know a lot about his history either. Some of it was shielded from him. And, you know, I thought that was a possibility because but I could see it more, and, you know, as Gary said, I became more masculine looking, and I don't know if it's because I look like a little old man now.
Now, is this something that is an evolution both physically, and you're becoming the taking on this male persona or whatever you would want to call it? Is there a similar spiritual evolution going on in you?
Between that, you know, that's right. The two of us are together. Yes, and you said, you know, Gary said, "Well, I'm not moving around much anymore." Asking him if I'm going out anymore, and. You know, we're just together, and, you know, we're just living this life now together.
Well, that brings me to the point of asking this question of the personification of this individual, Mr. Reeves, and Gene's psychological, I guess, involvement in all of that. It seems to be, at least to me anyways, there is a soul awaiting some sort of completion here, either the transition into one soul or Reeves' real identity or whatever it happens to be. There seems to be a movement towards some sort of completion. And what kind of sense do you feel that it will be complete? And do you have any sense of where it's going, I guess, is what I'm asking you?
Oh, yeah, I think, well, and that's what it seemed, you know, like, what's the purpose of this? And this is what we mm-hmm. asked all along when the experience started, you know, why? You know, why is he here with me? Why me? And I think that's the conclusion, too, that once the physical body dies, then we will, you know, be together and go on, evaluate and see, you know, what the next step in our evolution happens.
Mm-hmm. Now, Gary, as an observer of all of this, I guess I could ask you the same kind of question: is where do you see this going, and is there anything that you do as a facilitator to move it along? Do you monitor it? Do you guide, support? What is your role in this movement towards completion?
Well, what I have been looking at, and I've been dealing with a lot of other cases of twin souls, or what's called twin souls, nothing approaches this Gene and George phenomenon. But it from a spiritual perspective, what I see this is about is it's about that we're all interconnected in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Gene and George, they came here in this lifetime, he spirit, her physical, to show that they are connected from this world into this next world, and I think that there's a larger picture here, and it's like, why do souls split apart? I mean, I don't know that answer, but I do feel that Gene and George, their soul is in other lifetimes as well. This is only one lifetime, and they're coming together in this lifetime to move on. But I believe that their soul is in other lifetimes at the same time that we're in this lifetime in parallel realities. So as I monitor them, what I'm looking at is I'm looking at all the other cases I've been working with, and I compare those cases to the Gene and George case. This is a totally different situation. It's very different from any of the other cases I am working with. I'm also talking to not talking but emailing a lady in Australia that's having a similar experience, but nothing on the gravity of Gene and George. So as I monitor it, I'm looking at all these other cases and comparing it and trying to figure out what is the big picture here. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm trying to find.
Well, I think the big picture is what humanity can learn from these kinds of situations. If this kind of melding, or whatever you want to call it, is something that's universal and it shows us that in some way we are in always connected with everybody,
right?
So that you and I have a certain affinity for one another, and that just goes for humanity, period, which is not something in secular society that's easily either A, explainable or accepted by people. And this kind of instance kind of stands up and indicates that there is something going on. And the first thing that comes to my mind is the acceptance of the mystery of the Trinity and how Catholicity has brought this into being, either through enlightenment or whatever you want to call inspiration. Is there any similarities with that in the religious context?
In some of the Edgar Cayce readings, he talks about, you mentioned the Trinity. He talks about something very, very, very similar,
mm-hmm.
that the twin soul is a very sacred experience. But he doesn't talk about this physical transformation. He just says they split apart and they come back together at the point of completion, mm-hmm. to go back into one soul.
Okay, we are just about coming to a bit of a closure here, and there's about another 1,000 questions that I would have for both of you, but our time is limited. Jeannie, just a word about your book, very quickly.
I'm sorry?
Just a word about your book. Where do you get it?
Ask Gary that.
Okay. Well, then, Gary, I'll ask you three questions then.
Amazon.com. Mm-hmm. And you can also go to the publisher's website, which is www.twinsoulsmerging.com.
I see. Okay. And I understand, Gary, you're in the midst of writing a book, Death, Transcendence, and Beyond.
Right, right. I have worked with a lot of people that are dying, and I've developed a method to help them go into the next journey.
I see.
And I've been exploring how that journey takes form, and what they're to expect once they go into the light. And that's what that's. And I'm also writing a series of articles for New Dawn about the spiritual connections, to how you can talk to people that have crossed over, and this journey I take people on. And I'm writing an article now on what the spirit and soul are.
Well, an absolutely fascinating 45 minutes or so that I really hope that we can get you back on again and maybe drill down a little deeper into all of this, because it's something that, because of my affiliation with the character of that George portrayed, and also the wider cultural, religious, and human aspects of what's going on here, it's not something you can cover in 45 minutes and say, well, it's all done.
Well, all you have to do is send me an email.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to say, George or Jean?
Well, we're all connected. And I think that's the big thing that we found out. You know, we went into past life experiences and things that Gary and our other partner, Daryl, have done together. And sometimes you meet people and you think, boy, they're familiar, you know, and you have a good relationship with these people, and you continue that through your life experience this time, and we're just all connected, and so much of in this reality doesn't acknowledge that.
Well, that's
part of each other.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things that concerns me the most, that the reality that we live in just won't accept this other paradigm.
Right.
And it is a kind of a bothersome thing when you're speaking to people and you get literally the physical feeling that there's no way that they will ever accept this idea of what's going on. In any case, thank you both very, very much for joining me this evening. It's been an absolute pleasure, and we hope that we can get you back on very soon.
And I have really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good night now.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
Good evening. This is The Conspiracy Show, and my name is Victor Vigiani. Richard Serrett is, as they say in the biz, on assignment. Apparently he's hiding out in Seattle, and he should be back sometime in the middle of the week, and he probably will join us next week for The Conspiracy Show. Welcome, everyone. As I said, my name is Victor Vigiani, and I'm here this evening to help us along and try to figure out what's going on this strange planet. And there are many, many strange things going on that we just cannot explain. And in this hour, we're going to, the latter part anyways, we're going to look at the more physical aspects of our reality. And we're going to be speaking with Dr. James Woodward. And he is an expert physicist from the University of California. And he's going to talk to us about exotic propulsion and how, in his book, he describes how to make a stargate and how to travel in space without using conventional propulsion. And Making Starships and Stargates is the name of his book. And we're going to be talking with him about all of that. It's something that fascinates me to no end. I'm sure most of you know that a passion for the UFO phenomenon, and that is something that I've learned over the last little while, that these craft somehow, in the way they travel, use very, very exotic propulsion systems that have nothing to do with fossil fuels or any other kind of conventional propulsion systems that we use here on this planet. But right now, we are going to be talking about something that's, I guess, a little bit more ethereal. And I guess there's no other way of explaining it. Our guest this evening is Rosemary Ellen Guiley, who is, I guess, an expert on the, and I hope I'm getting this right, is it gin or djinn?
Gin is good.
Gin, okay, like the drink, I guess, eh? Okay.
That's right.
Yeah, Rosemary is a leading expert on the paranormal and the supernatural, the author of more than 45 books. My goodness, I can't even believe that. That's, you must write all day long, Rosemary. And she includes that 9 encyclopedias and hundreds of articles in print on a wide range of paranormal, spiritual, and mystical topics. She possesses an exceptional knowledge of that field. And I guess what we're going to be doing this evening talking to Rosemary about the whole idea of Djinn Universe, what they are, and we'll have to lean on her heavily because it's not something that I know a whole lot about, and I would imagine unless we reach down into other parts of our own lives, we might be able to identify other than the ones we live on a day-to-day basis. We may have experienced it and not even known it. So I guess the first question is, what is a djinn, Rosemary?
They are a race of beings who share the planet with us, and in lore they preceded us here. They were here on the Earth first and lost their place to us. We find similar stories concerning other kinds of beings like the fairies. Mm-hmm. They have quite a few supernatural abilities, and throughout human interactions with them, we've had lots of problems with them, and some believe that many of the djinn have hostile intentions toward us because they lost out to us, and they feel that the Earth ought to rightfully be theirs. I believe that they are very active in all of our paranormal experiences, from hauntings to spirit possessions to abduction encounters, attachments, and things like that. And in our culture, we don't really know it because they really haven't been on our radar. I've studied them for quite a few years, and when I started considering that they might be very active in a lot of cases of unexplained activity, problems, and phenomena, a lot of things started to make sense, mm-hmm. and I found that they have a major presence in what we call the ET abduction phenomenon. I believe that they are participating in this. Whether or not there are a variety of beings participating, it's hard to say. The djinn are shapeshifters, and so they could account for quite a few of the entities mm-hmm. that we put various labels on because they all look different, yet they could all be the same being.
Mm-hmm. I mean, before we get into that, and I might add that I spent close to 15 years very, very involved in the abduction phenomenon, taking a lot of my cues from Dr. John Mack. I spent a lot of time with him. So I've got a very specific perception of what that situation might be in terms of people experiencing that kind of phenomenon. But before we get into that, I want to ask you, in some of the writing that I read about this earlier this week, either was yours or I learned from someplace else, a race of a supernaturally empowered beings. Now, that word empowered beings implies that they've obtained their empowerment from someplace else. From any sense of like where they drew this power from or their empowerment from?
The accounts of the origins of the djinn vary and don't go into a lot of detail. For example, in very old stories, they were said to be formed from the wind, and that they gained dominion on the planet and fell into disfavor because they abused their own powers.
Mm-hmm.
In the Quran, the story is told about them as being comprised of smokeless fire,
right.
And that they were angels and made of pure spiritual light, and there were djinn made of smokeless fire, and then humans came along, and God told the angels to bow down to humans, and the angels complied, but the djinn did not. Their argument being they considered human beings to be inferior to them, and so therefore they would not do it, and they were cast out as a result of that. There are accounts of communications with djinn, and I've found that in many cases they don't communicate a lot. Their name means the hidden ones, and mm-hmm. I think that the ones who do have hostile intent toward us, which not all of them do, that they don't want us to know exactly what they're up to, and so they don't communicate very much. But some of them have explained their abilities in terms of they've learned how to manipulate the natural laws of the planet in ways that we have not. They've learned how to use magnetic energy and other kinds of forces that then give them these abilities that we call supernatural. Mm. They are, in all accounts, masterful shapeshifters, and they seem to delight in taking forms that disturb human beings. It depends on their motives. If they have a motive to be sexually close to human beings, then they show up as beautiful, looking like beautiful men and women. If they want to scare us, they might look like a lot of cryptids out there, really strange creatures that defy explanation, that look like combinations of animals or combinations of humans and animals, monstrous forms.
Mm-hmm.
It makes a lot of sense when you consider the core experiences that people have with beings, and that throughout the ages, human beings have had the same kinds of experiences, but we tend to put different labels on them, when in fact we might all be talking about the same thing.
So you're saying it's more or less culturally defined, as how we perceive them?
Yes, throughout history, we've had different explanations for beings. For example, let's take the fairies, for example. Fairies have practically the same origin stories, the same folklore, same abilities, same attitudes that the djinn do. And in fact, when I started comparing the djinn to other kinds of entities, looking for similarities and differences, I found that there are so many similarities between fairies and djinn that you could say that they are one and the same. And in fact, I've had corroboration from especially many sources in the Middle East that the djinn really are responsible for all of these different forms of entities that we put different labels on. And yet our experiences with them are very consistent. They're the same. Our ancestors were frightened of fairies. They had problems with them. They were shape-shifting entities. They didn't like people. They had the same attitudes toward people and the same lore in terms of how they organized themselves. They were the hidden ones. They were here on the planet first. And the stories are practically the same. And yet we think fairies are different from other kinds of entities, and they might not be. They might just be variations of the same thing.
Yeah, I guess we're pretty good here in the North American culture of categorizing all of these so-called entities. It's either this or that. There's no gray areas at all.
And yet the whole realm of the paranormal is gray. It's very blurry, and it's constantly morphing and shape-shifting. It's just of its own accord. It's like quicksilver. Mm-hmm. And, you know, researchers, including Vallée and John Keel and people who have attempted to look for the, you know, what I call the Oz behind the curtain,
mm-hmm.
have all said the same thing, that just as soon as you think you've got the answer, the whole thing shape-shifts and takes on some other form.
It's like trying to take air out of wallpaper as you're playing to the just move someplace else. Let me ask you, you mentioned John Keel, and I've done a lot of reading about him. The Mothman, could that have been some sort of representation of what you're talking about?
Yes, and in fact, I've talked about Mothman being a very good example of a djinn. And Mothman was very frightening to a lot of people, but really didn't act out in a hostile, evil sort of way toward people. In fact, it exhibited more curiosity. It acted like some creature who fell into our side of the interdimensional veil and got lost for a while. But Mothman is a very good example of that. In fact, I think cryptids are very good cases for djinn because of their appearances. They behave as though they are interdimensional in nature. They disappear very quickly. I do believe that they live in their own realm, and they fall through these doorways. You know, Keel talked about that a lot,
too. Of course,
too.
Yeah. We're speaking with Rosemary Ellen Guiley, author of Djinn, The Djinn Universe. And we'll be back on the other side. My name is Victor Vigiani, and you're listening to The Conspiracy Show. Well, as you know, if you've been listening to the last little while, this is not Richard Serrett. Richard is in Seattle at this point, doing some filming for his television show. And I'm sitting in the big chair, and I'm talking to the djinn expert, author of Djinn Universe, and her name is Rosemary Ellen Guiley. And good to have you with us, Rosemary. I want to address something before we get into the objection finale. I wanted to spend a bit of time on that towards the end. But what I want to get your take on is there's always this kind of gap between believers and non-believers, and I know that gap very, very well, being involved in the UFO phenomenon. It does upset me to a certain point. How do you deal with this gulf, or do you at all deal with the gulf of either uncertainty or incredulity, however you want to put it, or just outright cynicism? How do you deal with that in your work? Does it propel you? Do you address the issue, or you just let people believe what they want to believe and just go on with your work?
My feeling is that you come around to your beliefs through your own experiences, and I've always told people that it's good to be skeptical, it's good to look for natural explanations first, and before you leap to the paranormal, and believe me, I deal with a lot of people who want to just leap right to the paranormal,
right,
when in fact there are natural explanations for things. But my work is really oriented to the how and why of people's experiences. I grew up believing in the paranormal. I had experiences like most people do when I was young. Everybody has at least some sort of unexplained encounter or phenomena. And so these other dimensions, these other realities, were very natural to me, and yet I've always looked for a grounded explanation first before considering the paranormal. Over the course of my career, which is spanning about 30 years now, I have to admit that my own boggle point has gotten pushed out considerably in terms of what I am able to take on board as what I would call a genuine experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I do believe that people have been having these experiences throughout history, and we've applied the best possible explanation that we can according to our time and place and our culture and other influences upon us. You're not going to convince a skeptic of anything on intellectual grounds only,
mm-hmm.
When it comes to the paranormal. And I think it's really a waste of time to spend a lot of effort doing so. People who are firm disbelievers are going to be disbelievers no matter what evidence you pile up, until they have an experience that shakes up their worldview themselves. So I'm content to let the skeptics be skeptical.
And just let the cards fall where they may.
Right. And so I'm really more interested in finding out the how and why, looking for the patterns, the cross-cultural comparisons, the similarities throughout the ages, and then coming up with some explanations and also some information that's of help to people. Many of these experiences are troubling, and especially when you get into persistent unresolved hauntings, serial abductions and things like that, people can have their lives torn apart by these experiences. And so they really do need some sort of solid footing to approach their situations.
Mm-hmm. Let's move into the area of the so-called ET abductions, or as John Mack puts it, those people called experiencers or being taken. In my experience, and once again, I've been involved in this for over 35 years, and there was a point when I was very concerned about and involved in the abduction phenomenon, but because of the individuals that I dealt with and the amount of energy that they literally drew from me in their attempts to reconcile what was going on, I got to find out that they just want to talk about their experience. They didn't want to, you know, make any money on it. They didn't want to, you know, do any flag waving. They just wanted to find out what the heck was going on. And to the best of my ability, with my counseling background, I provided some assistance. But I found, in assisting the people, it literally sucked me dry, and I had to put it behind me. And then, as a result of that, I moved into the more political aspects of this. Could you give me an idea as to how you see the interrelationship of the kinds of things you research with the traditional notion of the extraterrestrial abduction experience? Is there a Venn diagram overlap, or the distinct? How do you see that?
Human beings seem to have had abduction experiences throughout history at the hands of differently described entities. And here again, we might all be talking about the same entity. Shape-shifted into different forms. And the motivations of these abductions are varied. I think that this is a genuine experience. I don't think they take place necessarily in a physical reality, but some sort of bridge reality. You could call it the astral plane or an interdimensional area, where the encounter actually takes place. And what our ancestors called fairy abductions, for example, where you would be spirited away into the inner earth to a place where time passed differently and you were in an alternate reality, is very similar to the ET abduction. I think we've just put a space age interpretation on a very old phenomenon, and that the ships that materialize may not be anything more than interdimensional projections. Some of the Middle Eastern sources that I've consulted about the jinn have all told me that the jinn just adapt themselves to what they think human beings are going to believe or participate in, and fairies carrying you off to the inner earth doesn't play anymore, but beings coming from allegedly coming from outer space does.
It does, yeah. Well, my experience has been, and it sort of is parallels what you've just described, people talking to me about being in their bedrooms and being lifted out of their bed by, you know, typically three alien beings of some sort, and then you're floating with these beings, and as you approach your bedroom wall or your wherever you are at the particular time, you literally move through the wall. You're vibrating at a certain level, and it just allows you to pass through that wall, and then they float out someplace and get into this small looking ship, and then you're sat down, you're perhaps stripped naked, and then you realize that the ship is easily 10 times the size of what you think you moved into. Now that sort of experience is just mind-blowing. It's not something that you can explain. So do you think that the jinn have the capacity to alter your perceptions about what's going on with your physical body and where you are presently in existence on one of these ships or craft or whatever you want to call it?
I do, and I've talked to a lot of abductees myself, and the stories all have similar underpinnings to them about how the experiences take place, their state of consciousness when they take place. For many of them, it occurs during stages of sleep, and they think they're dreaming, but they're not dreaming, sort of those kinds of conditions. And we are in some sort of altered reality. They have side phenomena like that's comparable to what people experience when they have out-of-body projections. The atmosphere changes. There's a marked shift in the feel of the air, for example. There are often electrical qualities to the air, like thunderstorm kinds of energy. They have tingling sensations, buzzing. I believe that these phenomena are characteristic of interdimensional openings, that these sorts of things occur when these rips open up, these doorways open, and these entities, whether they're jinn or jinn and other beings, they seem to have the ability to manipulate these barriers to make openings so that they can come through. And so people are in a kind of a liminal bridge or zone when these experiences take place. And I think that that's a characteristic that you can find in all kinds of entity abduction experiences described throughout history.
Mm-hmm. In your on your website, you've got a whole lot of really good, very basic questions about the frequently asked questions, and you know, such things as, you know, do jinn eat, and do they sing or whistle? These kinds of things, I guess those would be the questions that people would ask on a I don't know if you can call it superficial or not, but on a more basic physical level. It's quite clear that the jinn actually experience a physical kind of presence, and then they can also be portrayed or at least take the form of something non-corporeal. Is that a fair assessment?
They seem to be able to do that, and to be physical, and then at will be not physical. And what we find in the ET abduction phenomenon corresponds to that too. That they pass through walls, but yet they can grab hold of you. They seem to be solid and physical, and yet they aren't bound by the same rules that we are in our dimension. One of the dominant forms taken by jinn that we find in the abduction phenomenon, as well as bedroom invaders and persistent negative hauntings and spirit attachments, are shadow people. Mm-hmm. And this is a humanoid form that frequently comes into people's bedrooms at night. They can be seen during the day as well. And comes through the walls, through windows, up through the floor, the ceiling. In other words, it materializes into the environment, and it has tangible mass. It's solid. You don't see through it. It blocks out light. It's blacker than black. And if they act out aggressively toward people, you feel this entity grab hold of you. But yet, it can disappear in an instant. And I have seen these entities myself, that they can turn into mist or smoke or just vanish into thin air. And yet, seconds before that, they had tangible mass. And whether that is some manipulation of physical laws they are able to do, or it's an effect that is created, that they can somehow manipulate us to see that or hallucinate that. Mm-hmm. We don't know.
Yeah, I speak in speaking with a lot of the experiencers that I have, and I have a very close friend, and even myself, I'll share that with you, of being in bed and waking up and having this incredibly tangible feeling of absolute terror and dread. There's nobody there. There's nothing that you can see. Your heart is pounding. In some cases, sometimes you're actually frozen. You can't move. But you know that there's something there. So many people have told me that. It's just like, Victor, you can just sort of reach out and touch it, but there's nothing there. But you have this sense of absolute terror. What might be the explanation for that?
You mean the terror?
Or the
paralysis?
Well, let's talk about the terror first. The paralysis is something different. Just the whole feeling of just there's something here, there's an entity here, or there's somebody in the house, or whatever, and you're just afraid. And it's not a normal state of being. You know, it's not like you're paranoid about these things all the time. You just wake up and have this feeling of absolute terror.
In the accounts and I've collected hundreds of these accounts, really over 1,000 now. I've been collecting these accounts for so long. First of all, you're being invaded in your most vulnerable place at the most vulnerable time.
Mm-hmm.
We are very vulnerable in the dark when we're sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
And to be jolted out of that and confronted by something that you instinctively know immediately is not human it evokes a visceral, immediate, instinctive, and very primitive adrenaline reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that these entities vampirize us in that way. This is deliberate. Many cases, these people say that these beings radiate evil and hostility and malevolence. It's an energy that literally pours off them, and they want people to be frightened.
Of course, it's a mechanism for control. Yeah, Rosemary, we're going to have to leave it there. As usual, we always don't have enough time to drill down more deeply into this kind of stuff. But it is fascinating. I want to thank you for being with us. Is there anything else you'd like to mention about your book or your website?
Well, jinnuniverse.com is my site about the jinn, and I've done a couple of books, The Vengeful Jinn and The Jinn Connection. Going into this in depth, and visionaryliving.com is my main website where I deal with a lot of the other topics that I've researched over the years.
Well, it's been a pleasure speaking with you, and maybe we can do this again sometime in the future, as long as those little creatures don't interfere with our communication. They haven't bothered us tonight, at least I haven't felt it anyways.
Yes, well, thank goodness for that.
Good. Thanks for being with us, and take care.
Thank you. Good night.
Bye now. Rosemary Ellen Guiley, fascinating conversation. The next element of concern is something a little more tangible. And we're going to be joined in a moment by Dr. James Woodward. And he's a professor emeritus of history and an adjunct professor of physics at California University in Fullerton. He's best known for controversial physics and his proposals regarding exotic propulsion. And we're going to be joining Dr. Woodward right after this break. My name is Victor Vigiani, and you are listening to The Conspiracy Show. As the man says, this is The Conspiracy Show, and this is not Richard Serrett. This is Victor Vigiani sitting in for Richard this day in the big chair and having a lot of fun. It's been a great evening, and we're going to move on into something a little bit more in the realm of physicality, but nonetheless just as bizarre. We're joined on the line by Dr. James Woodward. He's a professor of physics and history at the California State University, and he has some very, very specific ideas about propulsion, exotic propulsion. And the name of his book is Making Starships and Stargates. And that is something of science fiction, but it seems that science fiction is now becoming science reality, slowly and ever presently making its move and intruding on our reality to a point where you just might not recognize, tomorrow from the next day or even 4 days ago because of the rate of change that's going on. And in speaking with and listening to some of the presentations that Dr. Woodward has done, he's pushing that envelope. Good evening, Doctor, and thanks for joining us on The Conspiracy Show.
My pleasure.
Yeah. Before we get into this whole idea of, you know, creating wormholes and you know, star drives and all of that, could you just give our listeners some sort of idea, and we probably all know this, but from the perspective of an expert, what are the traditional methods of propulsion that we are used to seeing used here?
Chemical rockets.
Mm-hmm.
Taking explosive materials, mixing them together in a combustion chamber and blowing a bunch of stuff out of tailpipe.
I see. And also just basically fossil fuels and all that other kind of stuff that's used on a day-to-day basis. So you put something in the front end and it blows out the other end and somehow this thing moves fast.
Well, sort of. Liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen are right. commonly used, yep. or similar. Hydrazine, various other chemicals.
Right. Now, the idea that we're looking at, and I guess I got this from one of the programs where I first encountered some of your work. Ancient Aliens was on the television, and they have a graphic on there where there's an apple on a table, and it's a cartoonish kind of thing, and there's a finger that comes in and pushes the apple and moves the apple. And the apple, I guess, expresses a resistance to the finger, pushes back. Mm-hmm. And under traditional, I guess, thought, that apple is said to be, you know, either friction that does this or whatever. But that's not quite the case from what this particular program was talking about, that there are other forces acting upon that apple that make it resist the push of your finger. Now, what are those forces called?
What you're referring to is the force of inertia. And in the context of something called Mach's principle, which was an idea that Einstein introduced, actually first named it Mach's principle in 1918, Einstein was convinced that there ought to be more of an explanation for why things push back when you push on them, even if they're unconstrained in an empty space or what have you. If you push on something, it pushes back on you, according to Newton's third law, with an equal and opposite reaction force. And that reaction force that it exerts on you when you try to accelerate it is the inertial resistance to motion. And Einstein was convinced that inertia should be somehow related to gravity and should depend upon the distribution and motion of all of the matter in the cosmos. This became a highly contentious topic. He got involved in arguments with a fellow named Willem de Sitter about this, and so on. Eventually, he abandoned attempts to do this, but it was revived in the 1950s by a fellow named Dennis Sciama and has been a topic of contention in gravitational physics off and on ever since.
So what you're saying is that somehow, in some way, shape, or form, external forces far beyond this planet and within the cosmos mm-hmm. are, in fact, exerting some sort of force on us right now, or on our physical...
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I just have a really... I just don't understand that. First of all, you call that force something? Is it something specific?
Gravity.
You call it gravity. I see.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
It's a gravitational action of the distant matter in the universe.
Is it? Okay. On the other side of the break, I want to ask you about your work in making that force somehow disappear. I think that's a fantastic idea that you've got going there. Anyway, we're going to take a break and we'll be right back. My name is Victor Vigiani and you are listening to The Conspiracy Show. And we are here to help you unpull that wool or the world from over your eyes, because there are a whole lot of hidden truths that are out there that most of us are just unaware of. We go about our daily work and just hammer those nails in and put that paper here and click that mouse there, and we think the world is what we see it is. But I've come to learn that that's not the way it is. And with us this evening to prove that point is Dr. James Woodward. He's a professor emeritus of history and an adjunct professor in physics at California State University, Fullerton. And just before the break, we were talking about that force, the inertial force that's out there. And in your work, what you're attempting to do is, in a very on a minuscule level, but prove the theory that that force can somehow be either eliminated or minimized. Can you tell us, you know, what direction you're going in with that kind of work?
Manipulated is probably the right word.
Okay.
Yeah, a number of years ago, actually more than I like to remember. But a number of years ago, I blundered onto some theoretical work of another person, and it suggested the possibility of transiently altering the rest masses of objects by taking advantage of particular aspects of interactions between inertia and local objects. It turns out that if you accelerate a local object and at the same time cause its internal energy to change, that the acceleration combined with the internal energy change causes the rest mass of the object to transiently change in a significantly larger way than you would normally expect. And what I've been doing since that time is working on getting the theory straightened out and doing some experiments to show that this is indeed the case by building little gizmos that produce minuscule amounts of thrust.
So in essence, what you're doing is you're operating this at a very small level, but you're obviously moving towards either conceptually or theoretically towards the idea that this can be done in a grander scale?
Oh, yes. It can be scaled. There's little doubt about that at this point. Scaling it will no doubt prove more difficult and tortuous than one might like. What I've discovered in the process of doing this is nothing is ever as simple as it appears at the first that it ought to be. But yes, the effects involved should be scalable, and it should be possible to produce thrust devices that don't need to lug along a lot of stuff to blow out of a tailpipe and produce drives that are suitable for operation in space. And if everything scales very nicely, heavy lift is a possibility as well.
When you use the word scale, could you kind of
make bigger?
Oh, I see. Okay, I see.
So yes.
I see. So you're not working at the minimal level.
Scale
that you're working
up.
At. I see. Scale it up. Okay. This idea of creating this form of exotic propulsion. Is there any, or are there any other that you're aware of, any other people working in this capacity right now that, you know, sometimes you independently come up with the same idea? Do you know of anybody else who's working in the same direction?
There's by global standards, a very small community of people who are interested in this problem and foolish enough to invest effort and resources in pursuing it. The only other experimental program that I'm aware of is being run by a fellow named Sonny White at NASA Johnson.
NASA Johnson, okay. The word NASA jumps out at me a lot. If you could sort of categorize this kind of propulsion that you're looking at, and some of the work that I've and I'm not a physicist by any stretch of the imagination that could understand it, but my understanding, if I could just sort of flip into the area of the UFO phenomenon for a minute, and some of the explanations that I've heard with respect to how these things might move in our own atmosphere, and I'm told by physicists that when these so-called UFOs move within our own atmosphere, they have a way of moving at, first of all, extreme rates of acceleration, up to 12,000-15,000 miles an hour within our own atmosphere, and they don't burn up, or they don't even cause what we'd normally call a sonic boom. And I've been told by John McDonald, rather in his books, that somehow these craft can move the air out of the way so that they, A, don't burn up, and B, don't create a sonic boom. What kind of propulsion would they be using, ostensibly, would you guess?
They're using something substantially more exotic than the sort of thing that I am presently fooling around with. The sort of behavior that you're talking about and is commonly ascribed to these things, mm-hmm. whether they're real or not, it involves being able to manipulate inertia to the point where you can make something inertialess. If you can make something inertialess, you can cause it to accelerate to pretty much any speed you want with minuscule amounts of energy and force and so on. And presumably, if you've got something that's capable of, through some sort of a field effect, rendering the object inertialess, it would also render the immediate environment inertialess as well. So if it were traveling through the atmosphere, the air, as it came into proximity of the vehicle, would be rendered inertialess, and it wouldn't create friction and cause the thing to burn up.
I see. The broader aspects of what you're working on in terms of the politics behind it, do you experience any kind of resistance from outside either governmental or political forces that are sort of saying, you know, Mr. Woodward, you better just sort of cool your jets, so to speak?
In other words, is there a vast government conspiracy to try and stop work of this sort?
No, you said no. Okay. No, I had to ask that question because.
No, that's okay. I understand.
Yeah.
It's the title of the show.
Yeah. Well, that's not necessarily the reason that I asked, but because of what I've read about the so-called UFOs, is that if for whatever reason this new propulsion system or any new anti-gravitic, electromagnetic, or even what you're talking about, whatever the new propulsion systems are, it will render fossil fuels basically useless in terms of propulsion. And that has many government officials and oil barons very, very worried. Do you look at some of the work that you're doing as leaning in that direction and possibly being taken up as serious and a threat to the oil industry?
No, I don't think the oil industry has anything to do with this, to be perfectly frank. Mm-hmm. The chemical rocket community, I'm sure, looks askance at this sort of activity. This would, you know, at the point where this becomes demonstrated and commercially viable and all the rest of that, there will be political and commercial forces put in play that are not presently in play.
Mm-hmm.
But that's going to be the chemical rocket industry. That's not going to be the
fossil
fuel oil barons or anybody like that.
Yeah. Well, when you look at it in the starkest of terms, you know, putting a man on top of a firecracker and blasting it up into space and doing what they do through NASA, it's pretty archaic. And there seems to be some sort of, idealization that this form of fuel or form of propulsion will soon end. And I'm sure that what you're working on just might be something that NASA just might be interested in. You could get a tap on the shoulder and say, listen, we like what you're doing, and here's a whole bushel full of money. Do you see that in the offing?
To be perfectly frank, no.
No. Why did I know the answer to that question?
You know, let me explain.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody in the space business understands that chemical rockets are not ultimately the solution to access, actually, even really ideally, to low Earth orbit, much less the solar system. And when you're talking about interstellar travel, realistically speaking, you're talking about seriously exotic types of propulsion, mm-hmm. sort of thing you find in the last few chapters of the book that I published a year or a little bit ago.
Mm-hmm.
The situation that you find is that the physics involved in this is sufficiently novel and sufficiently, how should I put it, out of the mainstream.
Right.
That doesn't mean that it's not good physics. It just means that it's not part of the mainstream view. It's sufficiently out of the mainstream that big government bureaucracies are not going to sink a lot of money into this. They are sinking some money into this. The NASA, as I say, is funding a small effort by Sonny White at NASA Johnson,
mm-hmm.
and part of the project that he's doing is looking for a way to produce serious space-time distortions, though the theoretical basis on which he's pursuing things is a little different than the one that I think is the right way to go.
Mm-hmm.
But the government is putting some money into this, and it's public. There's nothing secret about it.
No.
He's been on TV and,
of course, yeah,
in the media and all that. So, mm-hmm. You know, it appears as though there is a change taking place in what's reasonable and what's acceptable. I think that there's a very slight shift away from just simply automatic rejection of this sort of work to very, very careful consideration of possibly putting at least some modest resources into it. As far as putting resources into the work that I'm doing, the way, if your listeners are interested, they can do that is to get on the website of the Space Studies Institute, SSI.org, and what they will discover is that the Space Studies Institute has recently put together an exotic propulsion initiative on their website, and if you go to the website, they have a link to where you can buy the book, and the book's royalties go almost exclusively to support this project, to support the Space Studies Institute's initiative, which is broader than just the work that I do.
Sounds fascinating.
They can join the Space Studies Institute, preferably as a senior associate, for $100 a year, and some of their money will go into supporting research. Or they can donate directly to the Exotic Propulsion Initiative. So it's possible for people to help out with this, but NASA coming along with a large amount of money or some other government agency or something like that, it's probably premature for that at this point.
Before I let you go, I just want to get your one last comment on you quickly, if I could, regarding the part of the name of your book. You know, the name of the book is very, you know, Making Starships and Stargates,
right.
And wormholes and all of that. It's that to me is an absolutely fascinating line of pursuit that we might want to have you back on. Do these things called wormholes, can they be created, or do they just exist in nature?
Depends on who you talk to. There's some many physicists who are aware of what's going on in this area would tell you that that wormholes presumably are naturally existing objects at the scale of quantum fluctuations of space-time, and that the way in which to create a so-called traversable wormhole is to find a way to, with utterly minuscule tweezers, get your hands on one of these naturally occurring wormholes and then find some way of ablating it up to macroscopic dimensions. I don't think that's a reasonable way to go.
Okay. We've just about run out of time. I just want to give you a chance to plug your book, where can you get it, and et cetera, et cetera.
It's available on Amazon or probably through most booksellers. It's published by Springer Verlag, which is a highly reputable major scientific publisher.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not an obscure thing that's self-published, and you have to scrounge real hard to find it.
Right.
And you'll find it on the SSI website, too.
Great. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Woodward. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you, and maybe we can do it again sometime.
Absolutely. A pleasure here, too.
Good night.
Good night.
Fascinating, no doubt about it. Anyways, that's about it for the Conspiracy Show this week. Go to my website, Zealand Communication, and also go to richardserrett.com for more information about what you've heard tonight. Richard will be back next week to unveil more of the marvelously incredible world of the hidden truth and otherwise concealed reality here on the Conspiracy Show. Just keep in mind the words of our friend George Orwell. In this world of deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. My name is Victor Vigiani, and let's talk again soon.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.